Take your Bibles and return with me to the book of Genesis. We're going to be starting in verse 42. This and next week we will be finishing up on the our series in the life of Joseph and God's providence. The following week, on the 7th of December, will be when our Craig Golden, the state representative for the Empire State Fellowship of Churches, will be with us speaking on that day. And then after that, we'll be Christmasing it and doing the Christmas thing. And so want to draw these two together. And I want to start by saying that this has been a different kind of a series. And I can tell as I'm preaching sometimes that it becomes more difficult because we're doing things in a slightly different way than you're used to. Most times, especially in regular Baptist circles and in church circles, we take a microscopic view of the scripture. We take one verse, and sometimes even one word, and we tune our microscope down so we can see that very clearly. But if you've ever used a microscope, you know the problem that when you do that, everything else is out of focus. And most of our teaching is that way. One verse, this verse says this, therefore I do this. This word says this, therefore this is what I do. And I have found that that is one half of what's necessary for walking with the Lord. The problem with only having that one half is that you miss out on the larger picture. You miss out being able to connect the Bible and live by the whole Bible. I find that when people want to have a daily walk, not many of them can turn to Jeremiah, can turn to the Psalms, can turn to Genesis, and look at these extensive portions of the Bible and live according to them. It's because we've trivialized everything. We were playing a game this week called Trivial Pursuit. The object of that game is, of course, to complain that everybody else is getting the easy questions and you're getting the hard ones. That's basically the way you play that game. But you find that Trivial Pursuit is kind of the epitome of where Americans are. Lots of unnecessary, unrelated facts. And you find out just how foolish those facts are when you do what we did. We were also provided with Trivial Pursuit, the Canadian version. You know, it's a version that was made for people in Canada. Well, all of a sudden you realize what is common knowledge to the people in Canada and what we know are two completely different things. They're asking questions like, what's the first stop? Stop number one on the Alaskan Highway in British Columbia. I don't know. You know, what was the name of the second premier's ex-wife's great mother? You know, what was the name of the first lumberjack to do this or the last lumberjack to do that? All these questions that as an American is like, I don't know. But when we do Trivial Pursuit, it's like, I should have known that one. I should have known the name of that album. Or I should have known the name of that sports team. Lots of information, but the ability to put things together, the fancy word is synthesize, put them together and use them is missing. Because we don't train people to look at larger sections of the scripture. Well, that's what we've been doing. Looking at larger sections of the scriptures and saying, put them together. See how they fit together and learn lessons, not just from this verse and this verse, but from the whole passage. And that takes a little bit more. And so you've had to give a little bit more. No apologies, just an explanation. Today we're going to do more of the same. We've brought Joseph to the point at the end of chapter 41. God has brought Joseph to the point where he is now a ruler in Egypt, where he is now one of the stewards of Pharaoh, where he is now one of those men who stand in Pharaoh's place. Pharaoh had several. Joseph was one of them. And he is as high up as you can reach in the government of that day. And he's now in a position where the Lord will use him for step number two. What I first want to do is go through chapter 42 through chapter 45. Briefly. And then teach about it. This section is all about how Joseph makes himself known to his brothers. It starts out with a famine that has already been taking place in Egypt that we know about. That's what God used to move Joseph to his position of prominence. Now it's up in Canaan. And it's so severe that Jacob, Joseph's father, sends his 10 brothers down to Egypt, and he says, go down there and trade for food. Get us some grain. We don't even have grain to plant for next year. So Joseph's brothers are coming to him. But he doesn't, when they come down, he doesn't say, hey, I've missed you guys, or hey, it's me, or look what's happened to me. It's not like one of those Jerry Springer shows where, look at me now, you know, you threw me in the pit when I was a kid, but you know, I'm dressed nice now. Well, that's not the point. What he does is goes through four chapters of explaining and putting his brothers through things before he reveals himself to them. Four chapters. We pass it by just like that. Why do you think the Bible takes this much time? Don't you think that four chapters of the Bible, which is longer than some books of the Bible, must be significant? There must be spiritual, deeply important teaching in here. It must be key to the whole activity of Joseph. Otherwise, they wouldn't spend this much time. Well, that's what I want to point out to you, some of the things that are happening here today. First of all, a basic rundown of what happens. In chapter 42, his 10 brothers go to Egypt. Okay? It says in verse 7, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them. They're coming down for grain. Joseph is in charge of grain distribution in Egypt. So he's the one they come to. Traders were very well received in Egypt. They were very important people. Egypt depended on trade. Their lifeline of goods and services had to come from traders. They couldn't supply what they needed for all the luxuries and different things from the Nile, so traders were very well received. They were not unimportant people. And so when these traders come up, they would be brought to one of the governors, and it's Joseph. He recognizes his brothers, but acts like a stranger to them and speaks roughly to them. He immediately disguises who and what he is, and acts roughly and treats them this way. And he puts them through quite a bit. The first thing he does is he asks where they've come from. They tell him where they've come from. And then he says in verse 9, you're spies. Notice why he says this. Then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them. Now, we're going to come back, but that's a very important point. Joseph isn't trying to torture his brothers. This isn't Joseph's little revenge, some little game he's playing to get even with them. This is based upon the dreams, and we're going to come back to the dreams and what the significance here. But what he does is he starts treating them and making them literally go through the hoops, putting them from one trial to another. And they said, no. There were 12 of us. You see, it's interesting. Right away, they go back to, they don't even know it's Joseph they're talking about. There's only 11 of them as far as they know. As far as they know, Joseph is maybe dead. But they go back to that and they say, no, there are 12 of us. We're all the sons of one man. We can't be spies. We're all from one family. And he says, no, you're spies. And then he puts them in the rest of the chapter. He says, down to verse 24 at least, he says, here's the deal. One of you goes back and all of you stay here. One of you can go back to your father and bring this grain back, and that'll prove to me you're not spies, and the rest of you stay here. Then he comes back with a second plan. He says, okay, we'll do it differently then. One of you stay, and the rest of you go back. One of you has to stay here as a guarantee. We've seen this concept of leaving something behind as a guarantee before. Remember in the story of Tamar and Judah? Judah left behind his signet and his robe as a guarantee. In fact, Job left his robe behind. It wasn't a guarantee. It was a problem for him. But that's the same word that's used as a guarantee. So they all go back. They leave one of the brothers behind, Simeon. In the end of the chapter, what he does is they've purchased all this grain, and in their personal backpacks or their animal backpacks, Joseph says, put the money in there that they traded for the grain. Give them back their money, but don't tell them. Okay? So he does that to test them, to see what they will do. So he sends them back to their father, minus Simeon, but with the gold. That ring a bell. You're missing a brother, but you got money. Where have we seen that before? When they sold Joseph. Missing a brother, but they're going back to their father with all this money. Okay, there's a point, there's a plan behind all this that we'll see in a moment. Chapter 43. At the end of chapter 42, by the way, they say, hey, here's the deal. He wants Benjamin. He left Simeon there, but he said, we got to produce our youngest brother, Benjamin. And Jacob says, forget it. I've already lost one son. I don't want to lose two. I'm not going to lose Benjamin. You got to remember, Joseph, the son he thinks he's lost, and Benjamin were true brothers. They were sons of Rachel, his favorite wife. And he says, I don't want to lose this one as well. So just stay here. I'll lose Simeon. Simeon. Okay? If your name's Simon, you know, like poor Simon the chipmunk, this poor guy, his dad's willing to let him rot down there in Egypt. Oh, he's eating good, you know. He's doing okay. Don't worry about him. The famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, verse chapter 43, 1, their father said to them, go back, buy us a little food. Judah says, I can't do it. I promised them I wouldn't show up without Benjamin. Then they go through this retelling of the story again, and there's a purpose for that, which we'll come to. But the result of it was the father says, okay, you can take Benjamin. Actually, Judah has to leave his two sons, and he says, kill my two sons if I don't come back. Now, there's a real trade, isn't it? Either you come back with my son, or I kill my two grandsons. Very unreal, isn't it, Judah's reasoning here? I'll leave my two sons as a guarantee that I'll bring back your two sons, Benjamin, who I'm bringing down, and Simeon, who's already down there. So it says, when Joseph saw Benjamin, verse 16, with them, he said to the steward, take these men to my home, slaughter an animal, and make ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. So he brings them in. They're afraid because they've got the money in their sacks. Now, they brought the money back. They said, he's testing us. We're going to bring this money back so that he doesn't think we stole it. All right, so that he can't possibly accuse us of being thieves. They go through the meal. Joseph barely makes it through. He's so choked with emotion at seeing Benjamin. He's so moved at what's happening that at one point he has to leave. Now, he's helped partially because at the meal, his brothers are sitting in one place and he's sitting in another. The Egyptians were fanatics about hygiene. That's why they shaved their heads, because that represented, we mentioned, hygiene to them. And they don't eat with strangers. That's why when Joseph was a steward in the house of the Egyptians, he didn't serve or make Potiphar's food, because the Egyptians were fanatic about that. Well, at the end of this meal, we're told that in verse 22, the Egyptians wouldn't eat, physically partake out of the same bowls or anything with the Hebrews, because that was an abomination to them. So they're all sitting according, it says in verse 33, they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked in astonishment at one another. Underline that. That little phrase is going to be important. He took servings to them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was five times as much as any of theirs. So you'd think they'd start to wonder, what's this all about? Why Benjamin? Why five times? Why did he make us sit from oldest to youngest? And how did he know who was oldest to youngest? How did he do this? So then what he does, they're going to go back now. They've eaten with him. They've come back like they promised. So he commanded the steward of his house, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry. Put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest and his grain money. So he did. The steward did it. This time he not only sends them back with their money, but he takes something from his household, a special cup that the Egyptians would use for divination, probably a gift that was given to him, and he puts it in Benjamin's sack. So he sends them away, it says in verse 4, when they had gone out of the city, they were not very far, Joseph said to his steward, get up, follow these men, and when you overtake them, say, why have you repaid me evil for good? Please circle that word, evil for good. We're going to come back to that next week in particular. Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks and the one which he practices divination? You have done evil in so doing. He overtook them and he spoke to them. Okay? Can you remember any other stories where someone took something that didn't belong to them, hid it in their belongings, was overtaken by a relative and tried to discover what it was? Who is that person? Rachel, the mother of Benjamin. Okay? All of these things that the book is tying together. The reason I bring some of this stuff up is when you go to Bible, to a secular college, they'll teach you that the book of Genesis was a whole bunch of different books. And some ancient author kind of cut and paste. One author used the name Jehovah. Another author used the name God. Another author. And they kind of cut and paste and put them all together. And so it's a big mishmash. You begin to see that the themes from one set of stories and another are deliberately tied together. This is one author. This book is so intricately connected in its narratives, it can't be more than one author. It's ridiculous to think so. That's why I just throw that in there for you. Anyways, each one opens his sack in verse 11. He searched, began with the oldest, left off with the youngest. The cup was found in Benjamin's sack. It's always the last place you look. All right, last place being the youngest. They tore their clothes. Their dad had torn their clothes when he thought he'd lost his brother Joseph. They're doing the same thing. So they load their donkey, return to the city. Okay, when they come back to the city, Judah has to intercede, and this time he has to come completely clean about what's happened, about why his father needs Benjamin back. And for the first time in verse 28, he's talking about verses 27 and 28. Judah, speaking here, reveals what they had told Jacob about Joseph. See, all these years, Joseph must wonder, what's my father think? What have they told my father? I mean, I've disappeared. What's my dad think? Well, for the first time, Judah comes fully clean. And he says, using the words of his father, that, you know, I've lost two sons. One of them, the wild animals, is torn to pieces, and now you want to take this other one. What's happening is that a result of all of these machinations and different things that have been going on back and forth, finally, Judah comes clean. Finally, Judah reveals the whole story, and we'll get even more into this. And then verse 45, then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by, and he cried out, everybody get out of here. He wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Wow. He could have done all this the first time. Why do this? I'll tell you why. Because in God's providence, wrong must be righted. Not just a system of justice, but in the way God makes the world work, sin must be uncovered. That those people who have sinned must be proved and reproved. We use those two words in English. It's kind of interesting, prove and reprove, like to prove a second time. But when somebody has done evil, they must be proved. It must be proved what they've done, and they must be reproved for what they've done, made to feel guilty. They must have been made to confess their sin and to bring it out and to be made aware of it. And Joseph is not going to continue in a relationship with his brothers until they have been proved and reproved for what they've done. He doesn't just say, I'm Joseph, your brother. He brings them through this series of circumstances, and God's providence, by the way, cooperating together, brings them to confess their sin, brings them to feel remorse for their sin, brings them to feel the same loss that he felt, the same loss that his father felt. By the end of chapter 42, they're convinced they're going to lose their brother Benjamin, convinced they're going to break their father's heart, which never bothered them with Joseph. He makes them feel the guilt and the emotion and the fear that they should have felt for him. You see the point? That's what Joseph is about doing. So let's go back there and talk a little bit more specifically about how and why he does it. First point, it says in chapter 42, When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, underline this, why do you look at one another? Why are you guys just stupid standing around looking at one another? Ugh. He said, get up and do something about it. Remember I had you underline verse 33 of that same chapter? After he seats him at the table, the men looked in astonishment at one another. That's the writer of this passage. That's Moses saying, pay attention, dummies. Don't just sit there looking at one another. I want you to understand I am now portraying the 10 brothers as exactly where Joseph was. Remember Joseph when he starts out is stupid and unfocused and doesn't know what he wants to do? He's wandering in the fields and he can't find his brothers. And his 10 brothers are the focused ones who see him afar off, who notice him coming, who make their plans, who do what? They scheme to act towards him a certain way. The shoe is on the other foot. His brothers are the dumb, unfocused ones, looking at one another in dull amazement. They come to Joseph. He sees them coming. He plots and he plans, but for good where they plotted and planned for evil. That's the point. You're supposed to look at this and say, oh, the shoe's on the other foot. It's not the dull, unfocused, dumb little Joseph. It's the dull, unfocused brothers. Now what's Joseph going to do? And the passage is perfectly set up for you, but you've got to read more than one verse at a time to find it. Even more, it says, he saw his brothers and he recognized them, but he acted like a stranger to them, spoke roughly to them. And then verse 9, then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed. You see, God had been setting Joseph up. He wasn't simply using the dreams in Joseph's life to make him reach a high position in Egypt. It wasn't a gift or a talent Joseph had that, boy, can that guy play piano? Oh, can he tell dreams? God was using the dreams in Joseph's life to make him ready to be a ruler of Egypt. God had set Joseph from the time he was young to saying, you've got a role to fulfill in your family. I have a position for you. What are you going to do about that? When Joseph was young, he was arrogant about it, just telling them his dreams and, oh, you're going to bow down to me. This is the fulfillment of that. Notice it says in verse 6, Joseph was a governor over all the land. It was he who sold to the people of the land. Joseph's brothers came and did what? Bowed down their faces to the earth. And then we're told in verse 13, the 12 brothers, the very things that he saw in his first two dreams, the 12 mentioned, the bowing down, the dreams are playing a role. But there were other dreams as well that God had used to prepare. You see, up till this point, Joseph's life has been this series of dreams, apart from the interlude with Potiphar's wife that's tied to Judah and Tamar interlude. It's all about dreams. The other dreams God had been using have one simple theme, good and evil. Think of that. All of these dreams that God has been using to move Joseph along, in the dreams with the baker, the butcher and the baker, one was good, one was evil. And it was up to the interpreter of the dream to discern between the two, wasn't it? The dreams look so similar. And it's kind of interesting, flip back here if you would with me, to that particular dream, to chapter 40. He interprets the dream for the butler, and he said, the Pharaoh's going to lift up your head. Then in verse 16, when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was what? Good. These become key words in this passage, good and evil. We'll talk about why on a very, and in an even larger sense in the context of the whole book next week. He said, I had a dream too. Hey, almost exactly the same. This is going to be good. I know this is my lucky day. Well, compared to 3 days from now, I guess it was lucky. You know, third day would be very unlucky for him. He's the one who's going to pay for it. Same dream, same result, gets his head lifted up just a little farther than the other guy. Okay? The point being made here is very, very specific. Joseph, with that dream that you and I look at and would say it's the same thing, Joseph said, this one's for good, this one's for evil. What's the underlying theme between the Pharaoh's two dreams? the good cows and the, my King James says in verse 3 of chapter 41, there were seven other cows that came up after the river. First were the good. These were ugly and gaunt. The Hebrew word there is evil. When you read it in the Hebrew, it's the good cows and the evil cows. And Joseph has to discern what's the meaning of the good, what's the meaning of the evil. Everything that Joseph has been doing is not to make him into some Trivial Pursuit master who can read the future and who knows all the facts and who can, you know, play these parlor games. He's a ruler of Egypt who has to judge men. He has to be able to look and tell between the good and the evil. He's got to be able to bring out what's good and to bring out what's evil. And now Joseph has to exercise rulership over his brothers. It was the responsibility of the governor. Before you let somebody into the country, you had to tell the real intents of their heart. You had to tell what kind of person they were. I mean, in those days, who you're dealing with is everything. There were no way that you could enforce a contract once they went back to their home country. There was no way of telling about whether their facts were true. There's no way of checking up on them. A letter would take a year to go back and forth. 6 months one way, 6 months. You had to be able to read people. And the point of being a ruler and a governor was you had to be able to read men, to tell what men were all about. Now he's going to do that with his brothers. And that's what this is all about. He's exercising rulership over his brothers. And what he does is he knows the evil of their heart. So he's going to bring it out. And that's what's amazing to me. Just look at the steps of how he brings out to his brothers and exposes what's in their heart. First, you got to be cruel. You got to be hard. You know, there is no reproving, testing that isn't painful, that isn't hard. If you ever played a sport, the nice coaches don't make it. There comes a point where you got to be in pain or you're not going to be able to participate in this sport. He's got to push you in some fashion, make you run farther than you want to run, make you do something you don't want to do. When we test a pot, when we fire a clay pot, it's put under heat. And it's the extremes of the pressure and the temperature that test the nature and the quality of that pot. In order to prove someone or something, there's an element of cruelty there. There's an element of pain there. You know, it's not easy sometimes to make your children go off that first day to school. And you got to look pretty bad as a parent sometimes with what you do to your children. You can't love me if you'd make me do this. Well, I'm sorry. You have to do that. That there's an element that for me to be in that position where I have to bring out the best or sometimes prove what's worst, it's painful. If you've ever been in court, that is the most painful, intimidating procedure you'll ever go through. It is set up to make you quiver and quake in your boots. And that element has to be there. I mean, if they held court in somebody's living room, you know, and passed around the cookies and cake, and we did this, there'd be no exposing of the evil. There's got to be a trembling and a fear before the exposure comes out. And notice he maintains a distance from them. He treats them roughly and rude so that they won't come to like him, so that they won't get close to him. He has to keep his distance from them in order to prove who and what they are. When you're in that position of reproving someone or proving what they are, you really have to keep your distance. Two good examples. One, if you've ever been a lifeguard, when a person's drowning, the first thing you do is put them in a hold, and what's the first primary goal of the hold you put them in? What is it? To subdue them. You don't want them drowning you. The way they carry them under the chin, you know, your face, the person's face is going under the water periodically, and if you've ever been a lifeguard, first thing they'll tell you is push that guy under. You want them subdued because they will pull you under. They don't face you. You don't let them face you and hold on to you. You turn that body around, and how you hold them, that person is absolutely helpless because you can't help them if they get too close to you. Doctors are trained in that way. If you ever met a really good primary or elementary school teacher, they're mean as snakes the first couple weeks. They're mean, correct? They're awful mean. They can be nice at the end of the year. They start out nice, and the kids run roughshod all over them. The best elementary school teacher is mean as a snake. You know, big as a bear and mean as a snake. And they're that way, and they're tough, tough, tough. And then they ease up as things shake down. Hey, sometimes when you're doing this job, you look like, oh, well, how can you be so cruel? And how can you be so heartless? You can look that way at Joseph. No, he had a responsibility and he had a job to do. If he was going to be a ruler of Pharaoh, he had a responsibility to Pharaoh, but he was treating his brothers and saying, I know there's sin here and it's got to be brought out. It's got to be opened up. That can't be hidden. And that was his job, to reprove them. Even more, it was his job to make them expose it themselves. It wasn't his job. He could bring evidence against them. I was there. The truth is evident. He made them confess and bring out their own sin and their own sinfulness. Notice, just come with me if you will, see if I can find it in this Bible. I should have underlined it. I have it in my Hebrew. When they found the cup, chapter 44. Okay? When they found the cup that Joseph sent, he says in verse 15, what deed is this you have done? Did you not know that a man like I can certainly practice divination? He doesn't say I do it, but don't you know that somebody in my position can certainly find ways of figuring out who and what you are? But notice what they say in verse 16. Judah said, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. By this time, they were convinced that it wasn't Joseph, it was God. The deeper sin that was underlying all of this, they said, our sin has found us out. All of these troubles that we've had with having to turn over one of our brothers, with the pain and the fear we felt, it all goes back, and subconsciously, all along, this matter of Joseph is in their minds. That's why they said we were 12 brothers. That's why their fear, that's why they bring up these things constantly. You see, what sin does is it lies just below the level of your consciousness. When you've committed a sin, either you confess it, or it lies below the level of your consciousness, and it pushes you, and it bites you, and it's always there, ready to bubble up. And Joseph has to probe down and get them to open that up. And they realize, hey, it was God. God is now discovering and making and laying bare our sin and our sinfulness. That was Joseph's job. He can't have a relationship with his brothers until that's out in the open. When that's out in the open, it's tough enough to have a relationship with them, as we'll see next week. Because there's a difference between the exposure of the sin and the forgiveness for the sin. But he's got to expose it. That's why it takes so much time. This happens over the course of a year. Because they bring the grain and bring it back. They use it for planting. They use it all up and then they come back again. This is not something that's a quick, speedy process. Sometimes we have the idea of let's just get it over with and let's take care of it and just show it to them. I'm an impatient person. I probably would have tried to do something like this when the first 5 minutes would have given it away. Oh, it's really me. Just pulling your leg. You know, what a kidder I am. Tried to kill me. Joke was on me. You know, I couldn't do that. Joseph takes time. This idea of reproving and proving takes time. I have found out when I first came here, I figured that my process of getting a PhD would be about 2 years. That's what it was estimated to me by the men in seminary, none of whom had a PhD, all of them who had a different kind of doctoral degree. It takes time, and it is painful. And the time itself is a function of the process. It's not meant to be quick. If you can speed the process up, you don't have time to let things soak in. You haven't been put through the test. They have this new oven that's supposed to bake everything in like one-third the time. If you've seen that, it's this new oven that the French have developed. It's not a microwave. It's actually kind of like a convection oven that works from different ways. And it's supposed to do a turkey, an entire huge 20-pound turkey, in roughly 45 minutes. And they use it over there because they can make whole meals in a matter of minutes that they would have to bake. Well, that's how people want the Lord's reproving to go. Let's get it over with. Let's do it. Things take time. It takes time to act upon a person's conscience, and it takes time from Joseph's part. He was getting to know Simeon while Simeon was there. He had to see his brothers. He had to see changes in them. He had to see what was going on. Things take time, and it might appear cruel. How can you keep sending? He sent them back twice, right? They had to go back twice. They came down, went back, came down, they had to go back for their dad, and then the second time he pulled them back. It looks like he's jerking their chain around. It was God saying these hard-hearted guys are going to need every second, are going to need every one of these twists and turns before they come to the place where they recognize the evil that they did with Joseph and the evil they did to their father. That's what it took. And this whole four-chapter interlude was going to actually end up at the end of chapter 45. This whole little thing that we pass by is God saying, Joseph, if you want to be a ruler of your brothers and sisters, it's not a matter of them simply coming and bowing down to you like you thought when you were a kid. I'll tell them what to do and they do it. A ruler is someone who judges the thoughts and intents of a person. It's someone who's in the position of making judgments about other people. It's someone who has to do the difficult thing because he's concerned about character, which is what I've been saying it's all about. He's concerned about character, not just about what's on the surface. It's Joseph maturing into now he can not only act in relationship to the government, but he can do so in relationship to his family. It's Joseph proving, I am right to be the head of my family. When you come down here, you can trust me. It's Joseph being totally in that position. And that's what God's providence is all about. And we've mentioned to you that Joseph constantly was not in a place of being passive. This happens to me and, oh, I'll just go with the flow. God constantly made Joseph work and do the difficult thing in Potiphar's house, do the difficult thing in the prison. Constantly, Joseph, by the way, that was his whole life. How would you like when you're the guy who gives out grain, you're also the guy who says you can't have any more? That's a tough job to have. It takes a man of integrity. And that was the kind of man who God would use to reprove his brothers. Think about that. How much success have you ever enjoyed with your siblings proving them wrong? Your brothers and sisters. How much success have you enjoyed showing them that they're wrong? The words that come to my mind are slim and none. Joseph did it. But God used this system that he would put into place over these four chapters. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from that. Let's pray. Oh, Father, we love your word. There's so much here. Forgive us for taking it so lightly, for looking at it in such a, sometimes I guess a bit by bit.